Hi, Bob. Steve Manalik. I've just recently taken on a role at the Australia-India Business Council, so I wanted to focus a little bit on India, but thank you very much for your remarks about Davos. I think it was last year, wasn't it, that the Indians went to Davos and did the India Everywhere branding exercise. And I wondered what was happening at this year's Davos in terms of, number one, the presence of Indian business and policy makers, but also, secondly, was there much discussion among the business community about some of the recent developments, like the Tata organisation making the biggest steel acquisition in history, and the Aditya Birla Group making, I think, the biggest aluminium acquisition in history, and maybe some Australian icons perhaps on the way as well in that field. Was this an item on the agenda, and what was the presence like of the Indian business community at Davos?
What's happened to both the Indian and the Chinese business community, but particularly the Indian community, is that it's now part of the scene. The Indians were there in great numbers, but there wasn't a sort of a... look, here are the Indians. Aren't they... Like, 2 or 3 years ago, the Indians had suddenly arrived, and it was a big story that they were there and what they were doing and their effect on the service industries around the world. But that's not a story anymore, because it's just part of the scene. And just the same way as if you're producing coal in Australia, so at some point of time when we were about to double production of coal, it would have been a big thing in the middle of a discussion about it, perhaps. But they were just part of the scene. And the fact that the Indians and the Russians, those countries have got some very prosperous companies, and they're looking to acquire businesses in the West. There's one thing that did happen, though, that really interested me about India. And I was at a lunch with a company called Infosys, it was breakfast, sorry, and the guy, I was yarning to the guy, and he said, look, the cost of our software people is rising. The huge advantage we had is diminishing, because our software people are saying, hey, look at the salaries abroad. And they've been rising quite sharply. And, of course, as the world came to India, the demand for good software people increased dramatically, and just the normal way the market works. Aha. And he was explaining what they were doing, and that they're now going for quality, not so much price, quality. And we're outsourcing our software to other countries that are less, Vietnam, Malaysia. He mentioned a couple other. I think they're in the Australian coverage I gave. I think I listed them all. So India is now going into cheaper labour areas rather than using it itself and going for itself as a quality exercise. And I thought that was a fascinating change.
Robert, Meg Wise-Dollar from Resurgence. You tantalised us before with just mentioning Iran and the issue. I noticed you didn't mention Islam or the issue of terrorism as a topic of discussion in Davos. Was that discussed at all?
Of course it was. You have to choose between 10 things at any one particular point of time, and I tended not to go to the terrorism ones, because I sort of, I sort of know that. And yes, it's... look... we have a very big problem. Whatever we might want to do with Iraq, now that's one subject, but we clearly didn't make a mistake going in there. And what we have done is to destroy a lot of the moderates in the Middle East. You can talk to the Pakistanis and their moderates, and that's good, and you can talk to perhaps the Saudis and King of Jordan. But the moderate group of people in the Middle East have been diminished, and America is not, and Israel have been pushed down, and so yes, I think we have a serious problem there, and I don't think it's tackleable in the sort of way that you might have. Well, you've got to tackle it on the security basis, and you've got to do all those sort of things, and we've been pretty effective at that, I must say, full marks. But in the end, you've got to start to get at some of the cause of it. And the first thing will have to be that that Palestine-Israel settlement. We are not going to solve the terror problem without solving that. It is the greatest single festering exercise. It just lots of people in the Middle East use that as to ferment, even though often quite unfairly. But so you do need to solve that first, and then try and get the hearts and minds of people around the place. And it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy because, in fact, you have a leader in Iran who says the Holocaust didn't exist. Now, you can have lots of views, but it certainly did exist. And therefore, you've got a pretty irrational sort of situation there. And you just have to keep working at it, that's all. There's no easy solution.
Robert, perhaps I could ask you a question. It just seems we're going into probably a generational change in world leaders. Tony Blair is eventually going to step down. George Bush will go at the end of next year. I just wonder, who do you see as some of the people that will be setting the agenda into the future? I mean, Angela Merkel seems to be gaining greater prominence.
I think, I don't know the answer to that. I know the obvious people that that we all talk about. But I think we're going into an era where the balance is going to swing the other way. We've had an era where the profit slice of the cake has got larger and larger and larger. And I think we're going to see politicians come to power, not rabid left-wingers, anything like that at all, but politicians will come to power who will begin to lever that back a bit in different ways. And nowhere will this be clearer than in the States. And whether it be Republican or Democrat, there's going to be a lot more pressure to lift the wage segment of the total community. Now, that's a difficult thing to do because you start doing that, you get inflation and high interest rates. But I think we're going to see politicians act in this sort of way as they try and get the votes that are necessary, because there's no doubt about it that we've been having small rises in wages, and that's been fantastic because it's actually participated in this huge jobs growth. But I think we're going to see more pressure from our politicians in that area. And I don't know who's going to be the next, the two nominees for the States. I didn't go to the session where I actually speculated on who they might be, but I think that John Howard was very, very foolish indeed to have got himself involved in any one of the candidates, because you don't know how that's all going to turn out. And you don't know what sort of candidate. It might be that candidate, it might be some other candidate. It doesn't matter if he's right or wrong. Better to stay out of it. And then try and convince him your point of view when it gets closer to the event.
David Pennington, University of Melbourne. If one looks at the issues of climate change and water shortage, closely linked, of course, as you say, there's a lot of technology yet to be worked through to look at the various possible solutions, but the one common thing is coming out of that, if one looks at it and thinks about it, almost certainly the cost of water is going to go up for the ordinary citizen, the cost of power is going to go up, the cost of electricity, if one's going to use clean coal techniques and the various other options, are all of them more costly. How soon do you think it'll be before political leadership will start talking openly about those issues of rising cost for water and electricity as needing to be part of what we think of and what we need to adjust to?
I don't think it'll be that long, David, because I think that until Tony Blair talked about climate change 2 years ago, but pretty well the world's leaders haven't embraced it, nor has the business community. They have now. And it really has been only in the last 6 months that this has taken place. And so I think that you're going to start to get a much better debate about this. And I'd say within 2 years you'll see a lot of things talked about. But don't, in the question of cost, before we absolutely lock that in, that it's essential that we have a rise in costs, I think it's highly likely, David, I'm on your side on this, but don't close your mind to the possibility that we're going to get some technology breakthroughs. And I do emphasise that mixture of gas and solar, where the early tests are indicating that it's competitive with coal. And so we might get a breakthrough in those. There might be a series of things we can do which can minimise this. And remember, using our computer technology, we are increasing our productivity all the time. And that big broadband change I talked about is a huge rise in productivity. So if the rise in the costs is containable, it doesn't necessarily mean as bad a situation as it might otherwise be. But as it looks at now, if you look at the situation as it is now, then we are looking at very big rises in the cost of those things.
Thank you, David. Further questions for Robert?
John Allen, independent consultant chair. I hope you'll excuse me if I ask a question that has nothing whatever to do with Davos. Robert, sadly these days we don't see as much of you at CEDA as people like me who have been coming for 30 years have seen. One of the big changes in Australian life since we last heard you speak is the superannuation. Could you give us the benefit of your thoughts on the superannuation changes?
I think that the superannuation changes that were made in the last budget were ranked with the floating of the dollar, the lowering of the tariff barriers. This was a totally fundamental change in our financial structure. And the consequences of this will play out in the next 5 years. Now, let's just look at a few of them, the early ones. First of all, it means that negative gearing on houses is, for the average person, is no longer nearly as effective as investing in superannuation. And that's going to mean just as a matter of interest, you're seeing some press reports of it now, but it was evident the day it was introduced, that there'll be less rental properties and you'll start to see rents rise. And there'll be some adjustments as part of that. But the very biggest change, so there's changes, and of course it means that our equity markets are awash with money, and that will affect our stock market, and of course you've got people now selling assets to put money into superannuation with $1 million. But I think the very biggest change is not that. When Paul Keating introduced compulsory superannuation, he said it should go to 15%. And he said if it doesn't go to 15%, our people will not have enough money to retire on. And that was right. This government moved to solve that in the most innovative way that any government in the world, no government in the world has attempted what this government has done. And it's extraordinarily clever. They first of all increased the money in your superannuation fund, everyone's in this room, by eliminating the exit tax. So all of a sudden, you've got at least 15% more in your superannuation fund on July 2007 than you had before, because they took away the exit tax. And you'd have had to pay that if you took it out. But what they did, and I'll explain to you how they did it if you like, they said to me, and I'm over 60, we'll let you earn up to $175,000 and we'll only tax you at about 17 or 18% on that first $175,000. And if you've got a pension from your superannuation, like an allocated pension, that doesn't include in your income. That you start the meter on your work, not on your pension. Your pension comes in tax-free. Boom, boom, boom. Pension I'm talking about from your own private money. Right? That comes in tax-free. And then when you work, the meter starts at nil. And 100... Never before in our country, or perhaps any other country history, has a government said, we are going to make it very, very attractive for people over 60 to work. And that 175 goes down to 135,000 after 5 years. So I was talking, once younger people understand this, they say, well, hang on, why don't we retire now? and get the parents to work. It's a lot more tax effective. And so a huge change. It means that we were talking at our table about labour shortages. The ALP believes this won't cause people over 60 to work in the way that it won't change their habits. I don't think that's right. I think that over 60s people will work. It will be up to the corporations and to design work situations to tap that situation, to tap that. But the point is, the people who are retiring now, for the most part, don't have enough money to retire on the lifestyle that they want. And now they're being given this enormous tax incentive to continue working. And I think they will. And more than... I explained this to a group of retirement villagers once, and they didn't understand it. They do now, of course, but they didn't then. And can I just tantalise you with a thought? If you go back into the 60s and 70s and beyond that, in the earlier part of the century, when a female got married, it was not expected that they work. It was expected the male would provide the income. And indeed, my wife, she was a teacher, and she was immediately sacked as a teacher. It was law, as soon as she married. There was no choice. So that's 67. So what we did then after that was to completely liberate all that, and a very good thing it was too. But apart from that, as part of doing that, we put actually a social pressure. We put a social pressure on the female saying, well, why aren't you working? And there was a real pressure for them to in fact work. And not working was sort of a bit of a stigma. Now, that is not something I think was a good thing, but it's what took place. And what I'm seeing now is that a duplicate of that movement, where retirement, what are you retired for? What's the idea of that? You don't retire, you'll stay up. So it's a totally emotive thing. It's got nothing to do with facts and rights and wrongs. Don't get confused by those things. But communities, we needed the women to work in our society. And so to propel that, we had a sort of trumped up sort of social situation. It's sort of gone now. We need the retired people to work. We've now given them a huge tax incentive to work, as we did with the females, by the way, because we didn't have family taxes, we had individual taxes. We've now given the retired people a huge tax incentive to work and just watch to see whether that social sort of merry-go-round sort of develops momentum. And therefore, these projections about labour shortages may be, in fact, exaggerated, and they may be much further out than we currently forecasting, because those forecasts are based on the fact that at 65 the person, is male or female, is not going to work. And I think they will, albeit not quite at the same pace.